from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, Proposition 2, the California initiative that would change the way farm animals are caged and treated. Also, how everyone, women and men, can get through midlife changes. Also, due to a scheduling error on our part, Firouzeh Dumas, author of Funny and Farsi, will not be on today's program. She will be on tomorrow. First, every day it seems the top story in the news is about the economy. Various problems, both here and in other countries, have converged to create a global financial crisis. The governments of Europe and the United States seem to have agreed upon a new and expensive plan. Will it work? We'll see. Joining us with perspective in all this is a columnist with the London-based international newspaper, The Financial Times. Philip Stevens is in town to talk to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento. Philip Stevens, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
The U.S. government is spending hundreds of billions of dollars to buy stakes in American banks. Who would have thought even a month ago that the Bush administration would be partially nationalizing a big industry?
I think precisely so. And in Europe, indeed, in the UK, we've nationalized already effectively two of our banks. And a year ago, when the government in the UK nationalized one bank, it was too embarrassed even to use the word nationalization. It talked about temporary state shareholdings. Now everyone's had to own up. The financial system, come the weekend, was on the point of meltdown. Governments had no other options.
Are they really nationalizing in the way that that word is commonly understood, where government owns a majority stake or owns the entirety of a big industry or a big company and dictates how it's run?
Well, in the UK example, they're not actually going to run the banks, although in at least one they'll probably have a majority stake. They are appointing some directors to sit on the boards of these banks, and they are imposing, and I think this is going to happen in the United States as well, conditions. No more huge million-dollar bonuses. Smaller dividends, I think, in the short term for shareholders. So it's not nationalization in the sense that governments want to hold on to these banks forever. But it is in the sense that I think, you know, the line has moved between the market and the state. We've lived through the Thatcher-Reagan era, the Reagan-Thatcher era, when the markets were forever moving forward. I think what we're now in an era in which the state's moving back and taking a bit more control.
It's one thing for governments to say today that, don't worry, we're not going to take over things and start running things, but I think experience tells us that when you give any organization, a government or otherwise, a toe in the door and a lot of money that is forcing their toe into the door, what's to stop them asserting themselves more and running things?
Well, I'm not sure they'll run things. I think they'll regulate things. As far as the banks are concerned, there are going to be a lot more rules about the risk they can take, whether they can use these very, very, what are now called toxic instruments, credit, derivatives, credit swaps, some of these mortgage securities. So I think regulation rather than run is probably the better word.
My guest is Philip Stevens. He's a columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times newspaper. He speaks later today to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento. He's going to talk about the current economic situation and also what's ahead for the U.S. and its allies after President Bush leaves office. The current plan that has been adopted in Europe and in the United States involves governments buying stakes in troubled banks and also guaranteeing the lending between banks to free up the credit markets. It seems that this idea originated with the UK government, Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He persuaded European leaders, and in turn, the US government adopted the plan. Why did this come from the United Kingdom?
I think the honest answer to that is that the crisis hit us hardest and earliest. So we were in a position a couple of weeks ago in the UK where two or three of our very biggest and oldest banks might have gone down. So the government in the UK was driven to the more extreme measures, if you like, of taking public ownership or public stakes and guaranteeing all the interbank dealings earlier than the others. And I think what happened is that people looked at what had happened in Britain, saw it beginning to happen in their own markets in Europe first, but also in the US, and if you like took the British government's example as a model. I think it would be hard to claim that the British government had great foresight and, if you like, jumped ahead of the curve because it's such a brilliant administration.
Gordon Brown, of course, succeeded Tony Blair, and as far as I can tell, he's had a fairly shaky start. But in this matter, did his background as about 10 years as Britain's Treasury Secretary or Chancellor of the Exchequer, as it's called, do you think that helped in this instance?
I think it did. And actually, as you say, Gordon Brown had been more than a year in office, having replaced Tony Blair, not really seeming to know what he was there for. And all of a sudden, he's uncomfortable in many foreign affairs, uncomfortable in diplomacy. All of a sudden, here's something that he knows about. He's been interested in international economic affairs. So he sort of sees the moment, and he is a completely changed politician.
A few weeks ago, Germany's finance minister said that, in his opinion, what he called Anglo-Saxon capitalism, which is code language in Europe for American and British-style capitalism, he said this was finished. Do you think that this current global financial crisis is a serious threat to capitalism?
No, I think there's a word for the German finance minister's remark, Schadenfreude. and actually, almost as soon as he'd spoken, some German banks got into serious problems. So if this problem originated in the United States or the UK, it certainly affected German, French and other banks. I think what we're seeing is the end of a particular type of financial capitalism, which was really unregulated. This is not the end of capitalism. The market is the worst system we've got apart from all the others. So we're going to stick with markets. But we're not, I think, certainly for the next generation, going to allow banks to threaten all our prosperity by getting into these very, very complex and dangerous areas.
It seems to me, as someone who's not an economist, that the conventional wisdom about what's going on and how to fix it has changed almost daily. And it was just about a month ago that the U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said that they were not going to bail out Lehman Brothers because, you know, Wall Street couldn't just keep relying on the government to bail out troubled firms. But now I'm hearing a lot of people saying that that decision not to bail out Lehman Brothers perhaps precipitated the global financial crisis. What do you think? Should the U.S. have intervened more aggressively in failing firms?
With retrospect, with hindsight, I think it's fair to say it was a mistake not to bail out Lehman Brothers. I think I certainly thought at the time it was the right thing to do, because rewarding bankers for, if you like, bad behavior is not a sensible thing, because it encourages them in the future to behave riskily and to risk our money. It's called moral hazard. But I think with hindsight, once Lehman went down, people around, bankers around the world, investors said, well, if this bank can fail, they can all fail. And that was the moment that banks stopped lending to each other all over the world. I think the big problem here, though, is, and it sounds obvious, that this has been a global crisis. Until this weekend, governments haven't recognized that. They've been trying national fixes. A fix in the UK, a fix in the United States, a fix in Germany. It's only when we really got to the edge this weekend that governments actually sat down and said, look, we better coordinate this, and we can't just fix our own banks. We've got to actually fix the whole system.
The whole world seems to be troubled by this economic crisis. Is it fair to say, though, that it all started in the United States?
It started in one respect in the United States with the subprime mortgage lending problem, as it were, giving mortgages to people who couldn't afford to pay them, and then repackaging these mortgages in these securities and stamping AAA on them. But it spread, I think, throughout the world pretty quickly. And as I said earlier, German banks were happy to buy these things, so were British banks, so it spread. But the really interesting thing about this crisis, and I think it hasn't been spoken about enough, is that you could say it started in Asia. And it started in Asia because they accumulated vast amounts of treasury bills, of European debt, which they then lent back to the United States, to European countries. And we've all been living on this sort of credit boom, as it were, financed by the reserves of China, of Korea, of Thailand, and these other countries. And in that sense, this is a metaphor for the way that power in the world has shifted. Financial crises used to happen to them. They now happen to us.
How long do you think it'll be before the world's big economies are back on an even keel?
I think we're talking of 3 or 4 years. I think it's very clear that particularly the United States, my own country, the United Kingdom, some other countries like Spain have lived through this credit binge. And the hangover, if you like, is going to be quite a long one. We need in those countries, I think we need to spend a lot less, to save more, and also to invest a bit more. Now, I'm not saying I don't think there'll be a recession for 3 or 4 years, but I think we're in for a period of pretty slow growth over that period till we rebalance, as it were.
Philip Stevens with the Financial Times newspaper. He speaks later today to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento, that's at McGeorge School of Law. As well as the global financial crisis, you're also going to talk about what's probably ahead for the U.S. and its allies when there's a new president. What do you expect to change when President Bush leaves office?
Well, it's hard to predict. I mean, I don't intend to predict the result of the election. What I would say is that I think the next 4-8 years are going to be a huge challenge, both for the United States and for Europe, and an opportunity to repair some of the damage that's been done over the last 8 years. The challenge comes in the fact that the world has changed, that we can't, that Europe, the United States, don't run the world anymore. We've got these big rising powers in Asia who are, if you like, want more of a say in how the world is run. We have in the transatlantic alliance the possibility to say, okay, we agree, we're going to share power, but we want to redesign the rules in a cooperative way. But if Europe and the US don't get on over the next 4 to 8 years, I think we're heading not for a new international order, but to a new international disorder.
It's usually hard, though, for powerful countries to accept and come to terms with the fact that they're not as powerful as they used to be. I know that the decline of the British Empire lasted for decades, and the United Kingdom
still haven't got over it.
So what chance is there for the big countries of Europe, along with Britain and the United States, to come to terms with this new reality?
Well, I think it's going to be hardest for the United States because, you know, since the end of the Cold War, a lot of people have talked about a world dominated by a hegemon, the American Empire. There have been books written about it. And what's clear is that the United States, in relative terms, that's a very important word there, relative terms, is not going to be as powerful. The next president is going to be the first to be told, since the Republic was created, that America is going into relative decline. That means not that America's getting weaker or less prosperous, but other countries are coming up. That's going to be a big adjustment process for the United States. Europe, we lost our empires 50, 100 years ago. We still have problems adjusting, certainly in the UK. But that adjustment's going to have to be made. The reality of Chinese power, of Indian power, of Brazilian power can't be ignored.
And finally, Philip, this is maybe a hard question to answer, but can you give us just some idea of how the British news media and the British people and British political leaders, what they make of the American presidential election?
I think actually they find it extraordinary. And I think we're rather envious of it, the excitement of the American election, particularly because Mr. Obama is a candidate. But the fact that, you know, there's been a lot of anti-Americanism in Europe over the last 8 years, a lot of questions about American democracy. To see a contest between these two really serious figures, but very different figures, being fought out with the sort of vibrancy that I think American democracy shows, there's a certain amount of, you know, wow, why can't we have elections as exciting as that?
And do you get a sense of a strong preference for one or the other, or is there a sense rather that either would be better than the current?
I think it's pretty obvious if you look at the opinion polls, there's a sort of Obama mania, as it were, in Europe. He's a very, and there's a sense that, you know, the world's changing. America needs, and it would be great if America had a new young leader, a new generation. The question is either JFK. So there's that sense. But I think anyway, whoever wins, I think there's a huge amount of respect for John McCain as well, who's spent a lot of time in Europe over the last 20, 30 years. the sense of whoever wins has a chance to turn a page and to repair some of the damage done over the Iraq War and other things with a new president, start anew.
Philip Stevens, columnist and associate editor of the Financial Times newspaper. He speaks later today to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento, starting at 5 at McGeorge School of Law. He'll talk about the world economy and what's ahead for the United States and its allies once President Bush leaves office. Philip Stevens, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was delightful to be here.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Proposition 2, the California initiative that would change the way farm animals are caged and treated. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did something in Insight particularly please you? Email us and tell us what it was and why you liked it so much at insight@capradio.org. There are several controversial propositions on this November's California ballot. Today we start looking at some of them. First up is Proposition 2. It would change the way some farm animals are caged and treated in California. Prop 2 was put on the ballot by animal rights supporters who say conditions in some farms are cruel. Joining us is the Yes on Prop 2 campaign manager. She's Jennifer Fearing, also chief economist for the Humane Society of the United States. Jennifer, welcome back to Inside.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Why do you think California farms need strict new rules governing the way some animals are caged?
Well, Jeffrey, right now on California factory farms, nearly 19 million animals are housed in such extreme confinement that the animals can't stand up, turn around, lie down, or extend their limbs. This cruel and inhumane confinement of animals is the norm for egg-laying hens, calves raised for veal, and pigs that are used in breeding. It's simply wrong, and it ought to be phased out because we can really do so much better here in California.
You say these conditions are the norm, meaning the vast majority of these animals are confined that way?
That's right. And I'll use the egg industry as an example. Right now, there are millions and millions of egg-laying hens in California who are kept in small, tiny cages, 6 to 7 animals crammed inside each cage, where under the industry standard, the animals are given less space than a letter-sized sheet of paper on which to live her entire life.
This initiative treats 3 kinds of farm animals: calves raised for veal, egg-laying hens, and pregnant pigs. Why just those animals? There are many other kinds of animals you find in farms.
You're right. This proposition, Prop 2, goes to the extreme confinement of animals. And these 3 species of animals, for these 3 purposes, are the most egregiously suffering animals on California factory farms. There's a lot that's not right with the way that we're raising animals for food, but keeping animals intensively confined in these extreme conditions is the worst practice, and Prop 2 seeks to phase those out.
Well, you said these are the most egregious in California, but as I understand, California doesn't have much of a veal or pork industry, so how could that be a major problem here?
We actually do have a veal and a pork industry here in California. But more importantly, this is called the Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act. With a large dairy industry here in California, we could overnight have a veal industry here. And we want to put down a marker with Proposition 2 that says that all animals, including those raised for food, deserve humane treatment.
State law already prohibits cruelty against animals, and farm animals are covered by that. Why not rely on existing law to enforce conditions?
The reality is that time after time after time, when investigations occur on these farms, we find that local DAs and prosecutors are unwilling to apply the animal cruelty laws on these farms. You're right, the law is there, but it is never enforced. And it is important that we look at specific systems. These housing systems are inherently cruel. And as a system, it is cruel, as opposed to individual acts of cruelty, which the law covers, although not enforced. You know, we're out with footage today showing just shocking cases of egregious animal cruelty at the largest egg producer here in California and the largest funder of the No on 2 campaign. And those acts of cruelty absolutely have no place, and the confinement systems ought to go with Proposition 2.
We're starting to talk today about some of the propositions on the California ballot. This is Proposition 2. My guest is Jennifer Fearing, campaign manager of Yes on Prop 2. We did invite a representative of the No on Proposition 2 campaign to join us in this discussion. However, we were told that they're too busy this week. We hope and plan to schedule No One Proposition 2 for an interview next week. But I did get a press release from the No One Prop 2 campaign referring to the video that you just mentioned. And they said, among other things, it is our understanding that the ranch where the video was supposedly filmed fully complies with veterinarian-approved industry standards for egg farming. How do we know that the video that the supporters of Prop 2 are putting out there is real?
Well, that video
and
is the
a fair description.
Oh, sure. It is substantiated on the website for Mercy for Animals, the organization that produced that undercover video. There's substantiation on their website of both the location and the timing of those incidences that are recorded. But, you know, when we hear the industry claim that what we're seeing on there is standard and approved, this sounds just like the talking heads of the Chino slaughter plant after an undercover investigator documented appalling abuses of downer cows. That was the USDA Supplier of the Year for the National School Lunch Program, and while we had inspectors standing by, there was no shortage of understanding and honesty when an assessment by an investigator showed the truth of what happened to these places. If this is the industry standard, then this is exactly why we have to vote yes on Prop 2 to overhaul this system.
There's a TV ad from your campaign that shows some disturbing footage of animals being treated, apparently mistreated, definitely mistreated on farms. But one of them is a cow that's being pushed along the ground by a forklift. This proposition has nothing to do with that. So why was the cow in the ad?
Because this proposition has everything to do with laying down a standard that all animals, including those raised for food, deserve humane treatment. And just as current laws and current government oversight and the industry were standing by while those awful abuses happened in Chino, they're all standing by while these awful abuses happen to egg-laying hens, calves raised for veal, and pigs in breeding crates. It's simply wrong, and we need to vote yes. You know, the California Veterinary Medical Association, the Center for Food Safety, the Consumer Federation of America, thousands of other endorsements are urging a yes vote on Prop 2. It's the right thing to do.
The people who signed the no on Proposition 2 ballot arguments are a former deputy administrator of the Food Safety Inspection Service of the USDA, a professor of epidemiology at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, and a senior official at the University of California Animal Health and Food Safety Laboratory System. These sound like eminent and qualified people.
These are the eminent and qualified people that bring you instances like the Chino abuse. The signatories to the Yes on Prop 2 campaign are a noted professor from the University of California Davis's School of Veterinary Medicine, the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, and the executive director of the Center for Food Safety. We're pleased with our supporters.
It seems, though, to me like there are dueling veterinarians on both sides.
There is a very small number of California veterinarians on the no side. The California Veterinary Medical Association is more than 100 years old and represents 5,500 veterinarians statewide. More than 700 individual veterinarians across California have endorsed Prop 2 as well. There's no contest in where the veterinary support for Prop 2 is, and it's behind the yes side.
I got an email today from UC Davis just letting us know about various experts on various propositions, and a couple of them related to Proposition 2. And it refers to Joy Mensch, an animal science professor there, who's found that conventional cage systems restrict hens' movement and natural behaviors, but that free-roaming chickens are more likely to fall victim to cannibalism, health problems associated with increased exposure to their manure, and broken bones. Is there a danger of unintended consequences with this initiative?
There isn't, Jeffrey. You know, if I lived my entire life inside my closet, I suppose there'd be no chance of getting a communicable disease or getting hit by a car, but that wouldn't be much of a life either. 100% of animals kept in these tiny cages are suffering 100% of the time, and we can do better by these animals. And good management in cage-free environments can be equally productive and can be good for these animals and our health as well.
Prop 2 opponents say that if this initiative is passed, the costs of producing eggs and veal and pork would rise greatly and cause the loss of several thousand jobs. Do you agree with that?
We have a report that was produced, co-authored by the former state finance director, Tim Gage, that disputes those findings and proves that this is a modest reform and that, frankly, that Prop 2 creates an opportunity for California egg farmers to reverse or at least slow the decline of their industry that they've witnessed in recent years by producing California-grown eggs to serve not only to Californians but to the nation, who are increasingly demanding that their products come from farmers who do not treat their animals in these extreme ways.
I'm told that Daniel Sumner, also of UC Davis and the University of California Agricultural Issues Center, he studied this issue and he concluded that Prop 2 would have the effect of shifting most and perhaps all egg production in California outside the state. Would that trouble you?
If I believed it, but nothing puts the lie to that conclusion more than the fact that nearly 80% of the funding for the No on 2 campaign is coming from large-scale egg factory farmers outside of California, the very producers who would stand to gain if Dr. Sumner's conclusion were accurate. The reality is this is an opportunity for California farmers who have until 2015 to move in a more humane direction.
And finally, Jennifer, the Sacramento Bee editorial page came out against Prop 2, saying that you made persuasive arguments, but, quote, the vagueness of the Prop 2 ballot language has led some cage-free egg producers to oppose the measure, fearing their current practices would be outlawed. Could you respond to that?
The Legislative Analyst Office didn't buy this argument from opponents. It's sad that the Sacramento Bee editorial board did. Frankly, the Sacramento Bee's editorial board's conclusion that everyone should vote no on everything except one initiative, it shows to me the sad state of affairs over at the Sacramento Bee.
Jennifer Fearing is campaign manager of Yes on Proposition 2, which would change the way some farm animals are confined in California. She's also chief economist for the Humane Society of the United States. By the way, again, we did invite a representative of the No on Prop 2 campaign to join us. They told us they're too busy this week. We hope and plan to schedule No on Prop 2 for an interview next week. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, how everyone, women and men, can get through midlife changes. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online to stream our show. Go to capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, the Sacramento food bank Loaves and Fishes says it's feeling the current economic downturn nearly as much as the needy people it serves every day and is considering layoffs of paid staff. That story later today on All Things Considered. Menopause affects every woman who reaches midlife. And for some, it can be relatively quick and easy. For others, it can be a long and challenging experience. A Davis physician who's an expert on menopause has written two books on the subject, one for women, the other intended for men who want a better idea of what menopause is. Last year, I asked Dr. Michael Goodman how he suggests that his patients regard menopause. Should they celebrate it, tolerate it, treat it, or eliminate it?
Probably a combination of all of those and perhaps neither of those. Menopause is a life transition like so many. And I think from what I've seen, the women and the couples that traverse menopause most successfully are the ones that don't give it that much of a thought, especially a negative thought, that aren't worried that much about what's going to happen. Because obviously, hormonally, whatever's going to happen will happen. And I think the more prepared someone is as far as understanding what those changes is, well, what those changes are, while not worrying, the better they'll go through. But the wonderful thing, Jeffrey, is that there are so many different options, so many different ways that women and couples can work with each other and work with their physician and work with themselves to have a successful passage.
Some of the language that's used with menopause can sound medical. How do you describe menopause? Is it a condition that needs to be treated or should be treated, or is it something different from that?
It's different from that. It's a part of life. And philosophically, my feeling is that life is preparing to die. We all die, and the life we live is in preparation for that. And menopause is a step along the road, a marker along the road. Actually, the actual menopause, I guess, is a moment in time. It's the last. It's the final period. You don't really know that until you haven't had a period for a while. But the process can go on for years and years. I think the roughest time that women experience, if they're going to have a hard time, is certainly in the year or two or three sometimes before the final period, when hormones are rocking and rolling and are fluctuating a lot. And a lot of times after the final menses, things level out. On the other hand, there's many women that have very little problem during this premenopausal time. because their hormones just very slowly and subtly diminish. But then maybe a year or two later, when the hormones actually reach a very low level, they'll have more problems.
My guest is Dr. Michael Goodman. He's a physician who's an expert on menopause. His practice is in Davis, and he's the author of books on the subject, including The Midlife Bible, A Woman's Survival Guide, and Menopause, The Book for Men. Are there many women who go through menopause barely knowing it's happening?
I think, you know, it's hard to speak in percentages because whatever's happening to you is 100%.
Sure.
There's no such thing as a 25%, you know, chance. But statistically, in my experience, and actually I have a huge amount of experience in working with women and couples through menopause, probably about 25% of women, and these in general are the women I don't see because they're just smooth and skating through, probably about 25% have very little difficulties. It comes, it goes, and they really didn't notice that it happened. Probably about another 25% have enough difficulties that they may take very short-term hormone therapy, or they may use herbs and botanicals, or they may just gut it out for a little while. Again, it depends on every person's tolerance. But probably 50% of women, and perhaps a little bit north of that, will have enough difficulties that they need some sort of aid.
Where do you stand on hormone replacement therapy? Because I guess part of what makes menopause is the change in the hormonal balance in the body. And if you replace those hormones that are diminishing, then, I guess it's become controversial because of some negative health effects.
We all respond to our environment. If I'm going on the freeway and changing lanes and cut someone off and that person gives me the finger, I'm going to respond to that as that person perhaps responded to what I did. And what's more intimate to a woman's responses than what's going on in her body? And this is something that frequently are forces outside of her control, that her hormones are going up, are going down, are changing. Many women feel sort of like a puppet on a string when that happens. And how they do depends a lot of times on their reserve, on what their hormone levels used to be, and how they respond to that. That said, there's been a huge amount of controversy about hormone therapy, and I'm glad you asked me that question. I'm just in the process right now of writing a piece which is entitled The Case for Hormone Replacement. I've been practicing medicine for 35 years, and I've seen all the different swings in the pendulum, and I've been specializing specifically in perimenopausal medicine for the past 7 to 8 years. The study that came out several years ago, the Women's Health Initiative study that got everyone scared, was an awful study in a lot of ways. It was poorly done. It was misinterpreted. It was a classic example of the practice of medicine by the press. Fear sells a lot more papers than security.
But didn't the researchers prematurely end part of the study because they were finding that some women were developing cancer at a higher rate? Is that correct?
They did. There were some good things that came out of the study, but understand this. The Women's Health Initiative study had nothing to do with menopause. It was seeing whether older women, the average age going in of these women was 63 years old. When they ended the study, the average age was about 67, 68, to see whether starting older women way past menopause, de novo, in other words, they had never taken the hormones before, whether starting them on estrogens at that point would help protect against heart disease. They were following a lot of other things at the same time, and they decided if there were parameters that were changing that they were uncomfortable with, that they would stop the study. It turned out that after about 4 or 5 years, they were seeing slightly more cases of breast cancer, not statistically significant, but slightly more in the group of women that were taking estrogen and progesterone together. Turned out later, 2 years later, the data came in from the group of women that were taking estrogen only. And lo and behold, they found the same degree less of breast cancer in this group, taking estrogen only. This group of women had less breast cancer than the control group by the exact same percentage. Mm. Did you see that in the newspaper? Did anybody remember that? No, because that wasn't fearful data. Bottom line, and we could obviously have a whole session on this, the bottom line is that And it doesn't have to do necessarily with synthetics. It doesn't necessarily have to do with bioidenticals or not, although probably bioidentical progesterone is a little bit safer than the synthetic. But the problem was estrogen and progesterone together is more risky if you continue that past menopause. The greatest risk for breast cancer is woman's own ovaries that give her estrogen, that give her progesterone. So women that have taken, they've had, for example, hysterectomies at age 38, 40, 42, whose ovaries were removed and took estrogen for many years, 10, 15 years, comparing this group with the women who had their own ovaries, who hadn't gone through menopause, weren't taking anything. The group of women that had their ovaries removed and were taking estrogen had significantly less breast cancer. The difference? The women who had their ovaries in place were getting a higher level of estrogen and were getting progesterone also. So we've learned a lot. But the other thing we learned from the WHI was that I think was not necessarily to believe what you read in the press and not necessarily to believe, and this was a big one, not necessarily to believe what pundits, what medical pundits on TV, on the radio, online said. These were all people that said, oh yeah, it's bad. It's easy to say it's bad. At the same time as the study results came out, the people that really were quiet and looked at it, menopausal experts, knew right then, years ago, that that was a faulty study and that the results that they showed didn't apply to all people.
Now, let's talk a little bit about where the hormones come from. You mentioned bioidentical. Now, those are, if I understand correctly, hormones that are not generated naturally from the human body, but that are otherwise the same. Is that correct?
Bioidentical means biologically identical to what the body produces. Yeah. I use bioidenticals. The reason I use them is not because they're a buzzword, because two reasons. One, it makes sense to use something that's biologically identical to what your body produces. The second reason is because bioidentical hormones can be supplied transdermally through the skin with patches, with creams, with gels. It's my feeling that there's no place in this day and age for oral hormones. The problem with hormone therapy that have been the problem with supposedly stroke, with a higher risk of blood clots, with diminishing testosterone levels, is not the estrogen, it's the oral form of the estrogen. So bioidenticals can be given orally, they can be given transdermally, many different ways. They are synthesized products. The only so-called natural, and I hate that word, natural is a sales word. Someone talks about natural, they're trying to sell you something. The only natural hormone is Premarin from pregnant mare's urine. How much more natural can you get? That doesn't mean that that's going to be best for your body, but it's natural.
Is that a problem, do you think, that it comes from a horse? Because
no.
I know some people have a gut reaction against it.
Well, yeah. If you're a horse person and you don't like the idea of how these hormones are derived, and each time you take that pill into your body, you have a negative feeling, what's that going to do to your immune system? What's that going to do to your general state of health? No, you shouldn't be taking it. But bioidenticals are made by a chemist in the laboratory who takes... Initially, the definition of natural is from a plant or animal source. Bioidenticals come from either soybeans or from wild Mexican yam. It turns out that these plants have, as part of their substance, something called sterols, S-T-E-R-O-L-S, not steroids. A sterol is like a plant hormonal substance. And if you take a look at the chemical makeup of, for example, a soybean, lo and behold, up there in the corner, is an estradiol molecule. So chemists can split off that molecule and can then make something that is biologically identical. And you can get that by having it personally compounded. You can get it by a prescription for Estrace, Vivaldot, so forth.
Dr. Michael Goodman is a physician in Davis. He's an expert on menopause. His books include The Midlife Bible, A Woman's Survival Guide. What would you say to a woman who came to see you and was having a lot of difficulty with her menopause but just did not feel good about taking hormones?
First, I'd listen to her, and I'd just let her talk about what was going on with her. I'd want to hear what was bothering her. I'd want to hear her fears. I'd want to find out where she would like to get and how she would like to get there. And then I would tell her about all the different options, about hormonal options, about non-hormonal options, I'd especially spend time with her talking about lifestyle issues, about stress reduction, about mindfulness, about exercise, about dietary means. Because if you'd like to, for a woman who would like to be balanced and who would like to be successful in the transition, there's two things that are important. One is there can be hormonal balancing, but the other more important one is your lifestyle. You can take all the hormones in the world and you can be chemically right on the chart. But if you're sitting on the couch, if you're eating two huge meals a day and not separating, eating smaller mixed carb and protein meals, if you're not exercising, you're just not going to be doing it. At the same time, if someone was fearful of hormone therapy and they weren't doing well on the non-hormonal methods, I'd give them honest information that, yes, you can take hormones safely. We haven't gotten into this, and we won't have a chance to get into it today. I definitely get into it in both of my books. But there is ways of taking hormones very safely. And there's a case to be made now, even for women that are not symptomatic, to go on hormone therapy for their protective aspects.
You mean to protect themselves against cancer?
No, not necessarily against cancer. Colon cancer, yes. But hormone therapy has several protective aspects. And the important thing is there's a window of time to begin hormone therapy, and that's during menopause or very shortly after menopause. If hormone therapy has begun then and continued for at least 5 years and probably 10 years, there is no increased risk of breast cancer if the estrogen is given by itself or with just periodic progesterone. But what there is a significantly diminished problem with cardiovascular disease, bone health is maintained, there's less colon cancer, and cognition is maintained. So there's a lot of positives. Again, the risk of blood clot and stroke is more the risk of the oral rather than low-dose transdermal. So I'd give a woman honest information. But, you know, if I give her this information and she knows intellectually that, okay, everything's fine, but if her best friend died of breast cancer and if her next-door neighbor was just diagnosed and every time she puts on that patch, she's fearful, then I'd be worried about what that's going to do to her immune system. So I would work with her in the way that she'd like to work. There are many options, but what I tell my patients is don't reject anything out of hand. We'll go in the way you'd like to go. If that doesn't work, fine, we have other ways, but don't reject it out of hand.
Obviously, you're a man working with women's reproductive health. Do you get many women who say, well, how can you really understand what I'm going through? How can you really understand it? And well, this is maybe hard to know, but do you get a lot of women who don't come to see you because you're a man and it's their reproductive health?
Well, if they don't come to see me, I don't know it.
Sure.
And it's the same thing with a woman as far as my statistics, as far as what kind of problems women have with menopause or don't have. If they're not in my office, I don't see them and I don't know. You know, I don't get as many of those questions as you think I might, partly because patients are self-selecting. Partly because I've been doing this for 35 years. I truly love working with women. I've seen and worked with so many different types of women. And in a way, there's an advantage of me being a man because I don't have my own experience that would color the kind of therapy I would give. And this is the problem with a lot of the popularly written books that are written by women, is they're speaking about their experience, meaning here's what happened to me.
Like Suzanne Summers.
Well, I love Suzanne Summers' book because it really caused women to look at hormone therapy in a very different light. But exactly, this is what I did. This is what worked for me. Therefore, it has to work for everyone. And also, I enjoy listening to people, and I'll let them speak their piece. And the problem with me being male doesn't manifest itself from where I sit. But again, if someone has difficulty with either communicating with a male physician or being examined by a male physician, then I'm not seeing them in my office.
Sure.
Although I have seen many women who have been down that road, who have been to a female physician because they figured, well, this woman should know what I'm going through, and have come to see me because they said, well, she was just like the male physicians I went to. She just said, okay, here's what you should take. Here's this pill. Come see me in 2 weeks.
Your other book is called Menopause, the Book for Men. What is it that men most want or need to know about menopause? I guess you're talking about men who are in a partnership with a woman who's going through menopause.
Exactly. And this is for really partners of women, men and male and female partners of women who are going through menopause. Obviously, demographically, I'm seeing more male partners than I am female partners, but it goes both ways. You know, this book came from my experience of speaking with men who would come periodically to the office with their partners who had the sensitivity to want to accompany them and find out what was going on. And I realized that there was a huge gap in knowledge. These poor guys didn't know what was going on. All they knew is that they were living with someone they didn't know, and they had no idea of what they could do. And that's where the idea of this book, you know, pretty much came from, was to help. It's a tiny book. It's listed at 80-odd pages, but if you get rid of the fillers and all of that, it's it's maybe 70 pages of reading. You can read it in like 2-3 comfortable trips to the John. It's real short. And it's I think mostly from the sales we've seen, it's women that are buying it for their partners. Like, here's what's going on. But it's designed so that men have some idea, number one, of what's going on, physiologic, what's happening, and why it's happening. Number two, what she's going through. What does it feel like? You know, men are, as if you didn't know already, men are very different than women. We want things black and white. We want answers. There's not too much gray. So it's very difficult for us to imagine these kind of changes because we don't go through them. And also, it talks about what's available. And I think most importantly, it talks about how men can guide their partners a little bit and how they can help get things off their plate, how they can give them some space, and real importantly, what to do when there's nothing to do. You know, a lot of times, you know, again, when we're talking, we want to solve something. But a lot of times when a woman talks, she just wants to be heard a little bit. And sometimes just to be heard, just to get that space. Women speak two languages, only one of which is verbal. Mm. And that's the idea of menopause, is just to help partnerships.
And finally, Dr. Goodman, there's a chapter in Menopause, the book for men, about andropause, which I guess you could say is a male equivalent of menopause. But what is it and how is it different?
Well, first, there's really no male menopause because menopause talks to females. And andropause is a bit of a misnomer, although I use that word too because that's a sort of a popularly understood word. Men and women both have testosterone. Women have testosterone also, and it's an important one. Men have a lot more testosterone, and normally our testosterone wanes with the years. But about 20% of men, you know, más o menos, to lead into your next guest, about 20% of men's testosterone goes down abnormally swiftly in the decades between 40s, 50s, 60s. In other words, it bottoms out, and this can lead to loss of sexual desire, loss of energy, depression, poor sleep quality, can lead to bone loss and many different things. And it's been given the word andropause. It's just basically a lower testosterone output than that man should have at that phase of life. And this is something that is easily treated. Again, same disclaimers. You can't have a cholesterol of 500, be sitting on the couch, not exercising, and just say, take testosterone, and you're going to be, you know, Brad Pitt again. Doesn't quite work that way, even though you look a lot like Brad Pitt.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. Dr. Michael Goodman is a physician. His practice is based in Davis. He's an expert on menopause. He's the author of The Midlife Bible, A Woman's Survival Guide, and Menopause, the Book for Men. Thank you so much for coming in today.
And thanks for inviting me. Enjoyed it.
By the way, several menopause organizations have designated this Saturday, October 18th, World Menopause Day. Not sure what that means, if anything, but perhaps our interview gave you some ideas. We first aired it in 2007. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on the guests and topics on our show, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Today's engineer was Evan Matzler. Thank you for joining us. Sacramento musician Christopher Fairman made a name for himself with the haunting debut Born Broken last year. On the next Insight, Fairman tells you about his sophomore effort, 85-87, and you'll hear him perform live in our studio. Also, the author of Funny in Farsi tells you what it was like to grow up as an Iranian in America. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.